This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
How many discounts does USAA auto insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/auto discounts. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the... I have so many podcasts, there's always a slight pause right there, so I know which one I'm actually talking about today. This is the Western Rookie Podcast, and today's guest is Bob Barlow. Bob, how are we doing today?
Fantastic, Dan. Thanks so much.
Where do you reside in? What state?
Minnesota. Often in the news for terrible reasons, but it is actually quite a great place to live.
Yeah. So you're in the news right now for two reasons. One is the reason, the one reason. The other is where I'm at today. If it's negative 12 right now in Iowa, that means where you're at, it's got to be really cold.
Yeah, we're pushing negative 20 this morning. And then I have some property up in northern Minnesota, about an hour south of Canada. And it was, I think, negative 30 there this morning. Fortunately, I wasn't there, but it gets brisk. I think 3 years ago, we did a little family trip up there in January, and it was negative 38 one morning, which was pretty intense.
Yeah. It's cold. So I parked my truck in front of, I parked my truck in the driveway outside, mostly because my garage is just straight full of shit. Crazy. Like, I can only fit one vehicle in there. And so I had to move it out of the way so my wife could back her car out so she could go to the gym. And in just the brief moment of me walking to my truck, starting it, and walking back into the house, I could feel the texture of my pants change because it just went from soft to rigid in a matter of, I was out there for less than 1 minute. So that tells you it's cold out.
Yeah, it's intense, man. Yeah, we walk outside and the nose hairs instantly freeze up and you got to put on, call it Minnesota tough. You just got to you flex really hard and walk and just be like, oh, I love this. This is a great place to live. But the nice thing is I haven't had a mosquito bite in months. So that's.
Oh, yeah. You know, right. But when
no
you.
Snakes. you know.
But when you do get your next mosquito bite up there in Minnesota, it'll take a pint from you. They'll take a pint.
Probably will. Yeah, and so, they love me for some reason. I don't know why, but they literally just swarm me.
Oh my God.
It's terrible news. My wife and I decided a few, because everyone always complains about the weather and it's just like, oh, it's cold. And it's like, imagine that. We live in Minnesota in January. So we decided, I think it was 5 years ago, that we didn't care anymore. Like, there's no bad weather. There's just bad clothes. Like, we live here. Let's go buy some nice layers. Let's buy some nice parkas and just deal with it. And then it's just like, it's cold outside. Life goes on. But it's still, when it gets like this intense, it definitely is, you know, it's wild.
Yeah. So where do you live? Like, what part of the state do you live in?
I live in Fridley, so I'm about 10 minutes north of Minneapolis.
Okay. All right. Nice. Man, I don't want to get into it, but man, there's some crazy shit going on in Minnesota right now.
Yeah.
Just, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
It's totally bizarre. And I try and like, I'm pretty close to Minneapolis and my office is actually in Minneapolis, like downtown Minneapolis, where it's called the North Loop. So it's we're not like in downtown. Fortunately, like, there hasn't been any chaos or madness going on there. And at our house, like in our neighborhood, it's been pretty calm and chill. Yeah. So the stuff you see on the internet, like, that is happening. There's crazy stuff going on. And I've, you know, there's people on both sides. I have, you know, some friends who are like, oh, the world's ending, where this is going on. And some friends who are like, hey, well, this should be happening. But also I own a business and half my employees didn't show up to work today.
Yeah.
So it's pretty bizarre. Yeah. And I try and just, you know, first thing first, I'm worried about my family and taking care of them, and then my extended family, and just who can I impact and who can I love today? And the rest of the stuff, it's like, I've got too much going on.
Yeah. But, I like that motto. All right. So you reached, I don't know how this happened. I think I probably reached out on social media and was like, hey, who wants to do a podcast about Western hunting? Yep. And I think that's where you messaged me and talked a little bit about your experiences and things like that. And it was just like kind of like a real brief 20 years of non-resident mule deer hunting in Montana.
Yep.
Okay. And so I feel like as a non-resident taking those types of trips from Minnesota to Montana for a mule deer hunt every year gives you some pretty good insight to talk about it. So let's just kind of start at the very beginning. What was it, 2000 or was it 2005 when you went on your very first non-resident mule deer hunt?
No. Well, but first it all started with my dad started going like in the 90s.
Okay.
So that was probably like 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And Montana has a block land management program where basically landowners get paid to let hunters come out and hunt their land. So there's type one and there's type two. I can't remember. I think type one, you can just show up and sign a piece of paper and go hunt. And type two, you have to like make reservations and go out there. So back in like the 90s, my dad called up one of these ranchers and said, hey, I want to come hunt on your land. And so he got to know a rancher and did that. And so I was a little kid. I wasn't old enough to hunt at that time, but I was absolutely obsessed from a young age. Like, dad would come home and hang a deer in the garage, and every 20 minutes I'd go open the garage door and look, oh, it's still hanging there. That's cool. Kick ass. And then go back to playing with my Hot Wheels. And so the moment I got a chance to hunt, I was like, dad, sign me up. Let's go. So I think I was probably, I don't know, 12 or 13 the first year that I went. And then there was a few years I missed throughout time, but it's been quite a few trips out there over the years.
When you started going out there, was that firearm or archery?
Yep. Yeah, it was all firearms. So I rifle hunted my whole life up until about, I think it was 2022 is when I got a bow, partially because of you, because I listened to your podcast all the time and I'm a bow hunter, damn it.
Yeah, that's probably a mistake.
Yeah. And then I had a buddy who was hunting some land in Wisconsin, and he bow hunted out there, and the rut like was just, it was just wild. And he's like, dude, the rifle hunt is okay out here, but you got to get a bow. And so then I finally did it. But all of my Western hunts have been rifle.
Okay. All right. So 20 years is a long time. The first thing I want to talk about is your dad had done it for a long time before you went started going with him. Talk to me about what your dad would say back then about that hunt when he came back, whether he was successful or not. What was that like for him?
Yeah. When he went, it would always be, I remember one specific story. I think it was my dad and two of my uncles and my aunt and like four of their kids, and like eight people piled into a Suburban. So eight people in one Suburban driving 12 hours to Montana. I think they got like 2 or 3 feet of snow. So it was just absolute chaos. Mm-hmm. But they ended up filling all their tags. And for the longest time, it would always be doe hunts too. So they would go out there and hunt doe, mule, deer, because we grew up a pretty middle class, just regular family. And this was something fun that my dad wanted to do, but he didn't, buck tags now out there, it's like $700 for a non-resident. Back then, I think there were 300 or 400. But doe tags back then were probably like $50. Now I think they're 100. And so they would just, go out there and the Suburban full of people and waist deep snow and have all these crazy stories of, hey, well, instead of waiting for the deer to come up out of the, out of the ridge system, we shot them down at the bottom. And then we had to spend 4 hours trying to figure out how to drag it up. So that's one story that I know my dad gets a ton of crap about that one from my uncle still, because literally if you just sit and wait, the deer will walk right up out of there into the fields to eat. But my dad saw it and got excited and shot it. And then, literally spent hours dragging a deer uphill that would have just walked. So it was stories like that and the camaraderie and just the experience of being out west. It's completely different. Growing up, we hunted in central Minnesota in slug zone, where we were, doing drives through a lot of, cattail sloughs and things like that. It was more of a, hey, go find deer and chase them out. And it was just an entirely different experience in Montana.
Yeah. I'm always intrigued about, the stories that other people tell me, because depending on who you talk to, you start to talk about the glory days. Right. Like what was the best decade to be a hunter in the United States? And I don't know too much about like the 90s and what the 90s were like out west for any real species. But from what I've heard is it was amazing out there. And there wasn't the big winter kills. Like there was a long period of time where there wasn't any really big winter kills. And maybe I'm missing something. I'm sure I am. But as far as the number of deer and the quality of the big bucks that were out there, did your dad share any stories with you about that?
From his perspective, I don't remember anything particular with him. I can certainly speak to the ebbs and flows of the population as I've experienced it. Mm-hmm. I don't remember much, from his standpoint, but if you want, I can share some of what I've seen over my trips out there.
Yeah, absolutely. What was, so we get a reference point. What was your first year out there?
Oh gosh.
20 years. It been 20 years consistently, or was there?
I missed some years. So it was probably like probably like 97, 98.
Okay.
I would guess.
Okay. And so how old were you in 97, 98?
Boy, that's a lot of math. I think 12, 13. 12.
Okay. So that's pretty damn young to head out there that time of year.
As soon as I got my hunting safety, I was like, Dad, I'm going hunting. I don't care where you're going. I'm coming with. You're not going to stop me.
All right.
And so.
So I want to put a pause on the quantity and quality talk and talk about what it was like for a 12, 13 year old to go out like on their first non-whitetail hunt in a different state. What was that like? What was that excitement level for you like?
Oh, I was absolutely jacked.
Yeah.
I was just bouncing off the wall. And what we would do back then is we would leave on Friday night. We'd pack up, leave Friday night, drive through the entire night, get there Saturday morning for the opening of the season and to start hunting right away.
Yeah.
So, I might've slept in the truck a couple hours, but as soon as we got there, I was just bright eyed and bushy tailed and ready to go.
Yeah.
And just the landscape, like the sun comes up, like they call it big sky country. But when you see your first sunrise out there, and we're in like Southeast Montana, so it's not mountains, it's mostly, plains and some hills.
Yeah.
And it was just unbelievable. Like, I can see forever. And then I remember, like, okay, I can see forever, but there's no deer anywhere. What's going on? And I'm sitting there and, you know, just this giant sage field and then a little ridge. And I'm sitting there and I'm sitting there and, oh my gosh, suddenly there's 10 deer in front of me at 100 yards. Yeah. Where did they come from? Yeah. Surely I would have seen them walk up. And just being shocked of, like, how did these deer appear out of thin air? Because I turned my head once and they weren't there. And then I turned back and suddenly they appeared. So I remember being just experiencing that, like just a shock of how do these deer appear out of thin air?
Yeah.
And then just the different, you know, it's a different hunt too. We're in Minnesota, we're either sitting in a stand or doing drives, and there it's a lot of time in the pickup truck cruising around, because we would be on ranches or on, you know, state land, and you're glassing and trying to locate where the deer are. So it was just really cool to experience a whole new setting.
Yeah. And maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, I'm going to go from 97, 98. Social media wasn't a thing quite yet, as it is today. So, like, your first handful of trips out there, I mean, this is before the big Western boom, the big, like, public land style, you know, people. I'll say this. If I knew how easy it was to go west, pick up a tag, and start hunting before social media and before things like Onyx and things like that, I would have definitely been out there earlier. But I didn't know, I didn't know that there was educational things available. There was probably parts of me that didn't even know that I could go to another state and hunt. When I first started hunting. And so I feel like now it's extremely chaotic. You hear people bitching about, like, trailheads being overrun and honey holes not being honey holes anymore for a resident. But you guys were out there before that. Did you guys ever run into any, first off, did you ever run into any other hunters that early in the game? And if you did, like, were they locals? Were they non-residents? And what were the interactions like?
Yeah. It's a crazy story. The ranch that we stayed at. So again, this was one of those, you know, where the rancher got paid to have us hunt, and they had a little spot in their house where we could sleep and camp right in their house. So I think this was maybe my second or third trip out there. So I was 13 or 14 years old, and we're getting settled into camp. And, I remember walking out of the house, and sure enough, I see my school bus driver walking into the house. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Arvy? And for him, it was probably his worst nightmare, because I was a complete asshole on the school bus. Like, I was for sure to have a front seat about 33% of the year, because I would, you know, be dicking around in the back of the bus, and he'd pull over and, Bob, come to the front seat, you know, and then I'd have to sit in the front seat. And then we always, like, me and this other kid would always get the front seat on the bus, and we made up the song. It's like, American Legion, pour me one more beer. American Legion, yeah, I'm coming here. Don't come knocking on my door. I'm passed out on the floor, because we knew that our bus driver would go to the Legion. So we would sit behind him and just make his life miserable by singing the song about him drinking. Like, just a total asshole 13-year-old, you know?
Right.
And he's going out to, I'm going to go to Montana hunting with my buddies, and we're going to smash, like, and all he did was drink out there. It was amazing. Yeah. And then he walks in and he sees this little, you know, pipsqueak kid there that
he's trying to get away from.
Like, the look on his face, he's like, you've got to be kidding me. This can't be real. So we ran into him. That was pretty interesting. But other than that, we would see a few hunters as we're talking about this. One of the crazy things about that time was, like, there was no Onyx. Mm-hmm. And so we had paper maps. We had these big paper maps that you could unfold, and then, you know, good luck trying to get it folded back up how it was supposed to be. And trying to figure out where we actually were hunting and what land we could hunt on. And there were a number of times that we got our ass chewed out by ranchers, because we thought we were on a piece of state land, but no, that was a fence post, you know, 500 yards that way. And we're like, oh, sorry, we thought we were on the right piece, because you didn't know. We didn't have Garmin's. We didn't have Onyx. So it was just a paper map. Well, I think this is it. Yeah. Or the other thing, you would talk to a rancher and they'd say, yeah, I got the land up to the, if you go to the third tree, and then you'll see an old bent fence there, and just hunt on the left side of that, but not the right side. If you go on the right side, the neighbor will shoot you. And it's like, yeah. Okay, yeah, sounds promising. We'll go try it out.
Right.
So that was one of the craziest things too, of just not real, like, we had a pretty good idea of where we were most of the time, but there were certainly instances where it's like, I don't think we're where we're supposed to be. And we're not trying to be, we're not trying to trespass, but you know,
yeah,
we would.
And I think back then, I know when I first started hunting before Onyx, I think my first trip to Nebraska, I didn't have Onyx. And so on my first trip, it was all paper maps. It was a plat map. And then the rancher who was a relation to me had a giant map of all the sections that he owned. And it was, they were all highlighted. And he had a little dot where the house was. And then I had to count sections, like basically fence posts, because it was everything out there was in a section for the most part. I had to guess where I was at. And I know for a, like, I know that I, like, I'm sure, and I guess I don't know for a fact, but I'm sure I corner crossed where I shouldn't have corner crossed, or like maybe the road was private and I drove down to get to a piece or whatever. But, and I'm sure people back then were a little more lenient with actually, no, this is the invisible line, not this. But now, not only is it beneficial for the hunter, but it's also beneficial for the rancher to be like, actually, in your pocket right now, you have an Onyx membership, and it's telling you right now that you're trespassing. You know better than that. And, you know, and so that's where they probably get more pissed off now, is because of the technology that's available to everybody who goes and hunts public.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, back to, oh, so the original, like, we didn't see a ton of hunting. Like, there were other hunters out there, but it wasn't overrun or crazy or anything like that.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. And then throughout the course of your time, you know, this is where I'd like you to elaborate on the ebbs and flows of the deer herd, or, you know, like what it was like, what it was like the first handful of years going out there, because I've been going to South Dakota now for several years, and I've seen an ebb and like starting to see an ebb and flow of like peak, and then it dropping off of a peak more into a valley. And dude, there was times where I went out there and I was seeing thousands of deer, nothing like crazy giant, but from a number standpoint, thousands of deer when I would go out there. And that kind of reminds me how much I sucked when I first started mule deer hunting. There was 1,000 deer in there, I couldn't get close to them. It blew my mind. So what was it like?
That's a lot of eyeballs.
Exactly. What was it like the first handful of years going out there from a quality and quantity standpoint?
I mean, we had ebbs and flows. It started off slow, where there would be enough deer where we would always fill our tags. And that's one thing. I think every time I've been there, I've filled my tag, which has been pretty cool. And again, that's with a rifle. A lot of those years were only does. And then more recently, over like the last 10 years, have I started getting buck tags. So I've always been fortunate enough to, you know, come home with my tag filled. So that, and pretty much everyone in our party too. But there's certainly the first few years I was out there was some deer. It was enough where we could fill our tags. But then I think it was probably around 2014 that I was out there with three buddies. I was probably 18 or 19 at the time, maybe 20. And we were having a hard time. The ranch where we normally hunted, we were having a hard time. And the state land around there, we just weren't turning anything up. And we were in town getting some groceries, and we ran into a guy. And, you know, we're like, yeah, we're just here hunting. And he was just a really cool guy. And we're like, yeah, we're trying to fill four doe tags or three more doe tags. And we only got one night left. And he's like, I got about 75 head out in my pivot. Like, why don't you go shoot some of those? And we're like, okay. And so he draws us a little map, you know, on a piece of paper on the hood of his truck. He's like, go over this bridge and you'll see his field, and go sit behind the hay bales and, you know, you sit behind the hay bales, and right about with 5 minutes left, the deer will walk out and you can shoot them. And we're like, okay, let's go try it. We're not seeing anything where we are. And sure enough, we went out there. Somehow we found the hay bales he was talking about, and we sat down. Nothing. 5 minutes before, you know, shooting light was over, deer walked out and we shot him. And we're like, oh, this was a pretty good deal. So after that year, we ended up, like, I sent that rancher a thank you card and, you know, got his phone number, and we just connected on just the way we view the world and, you know, some of our thoughts and faith and stuff like that. And so then I'm like, hey, can we come hunt your property? And so then when we started going to that property there, and then even the public land around there, it was hundreds and hundreds of deer. Like, it was outstanding. Like, you would get up in the morning and it'd be like, oh, there's 50 muleys there. There's 30 whitetails there. There's 20 muleys there. And as far as the eye could see, anywhere you could sit, you could, you know, glass for miles and to see deer and deer and deer everywhere.
Yeah.
And that was really, we had a good stretch for about 4 or 5 years where it was like that. And then we hit a slow cycle where everything slowed down. And I remember going out there, and even like we'd always stop at a restaurant on the way in into camp, and all, you know, everyone like, oh, there's no deer out there. It's a horrible year. There's nothing left. This area where we were hunting, we were still able to find some deer, but it was definitely down. And then it went back up like 2018 through 2020. The numbers were really solid again. And that was crazy because Montana, you could get 8 doe tags, which I thought was absolutely stupid. I'm like, why in the world are they allowing people to do this? We would never, you know, sometimes we might get 2, but they were selling so many tags. I thought it was just absurd. And now the last 3 years, it's been terrible. The numbers have been like absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. This year was probably the toughest year we ever had out there just see, because I would sit up on a knob and just glass for miles and miles, where I'm used to, like, even if they're a mile away, it's fun to see deer. Mm. Hey, there's 15 over there. And it would be like, okay, I saw 4 deer tonight. This is not normal. It's not good.
Yeah. What about?
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
The locals, when you go out there and you're in a valley of, from a quantity standpoint, and when I mean valley, I mean like peaks and valleys of deer numbers. What are the locals saying is the result of low deer numbers?
EHD or blue tongue is probably one of the biggest drivers. That I know they've been hit pretty hard the last few years, or especially not 2 years ago, I think they were hit pretty hard. That's probably the biggest thing I'll hear from locals will be blue tongue gets blamed for the low volume. And then the 8 tags too, that was something that a lot of people didn't like that. And myself as a non-resident, I'm like, it's just like, what in the world are we doing here? Why would we allow someone to buy 8 tags?
Yeah. Well, and I think what you see is it takes a handful of years for regulations to adjust on low numbers, because the DNR and whoever comes up with the tag allocations, I'm sure they can't just go up to one hunter or a handful of hunters and go, tell me what you saw. And they're going to be, it was horrible. Okay, well, we're going to use that information to adjust. It probably takes a handful of years for that to happen. And by then, if you're a good hunter and when you have low numbers and you're still filling 8 tags, potentially, there's someone filling 8 tags, then you can do that. Like, you're going to see a big dip, especially if you have good hunters in low numbered areas. And so, what was that in like conjunction with a bad winter or winter kill or that you can remember? Because I hear out west, I hear EHD and winter kill are some of the biggest threats.
Yeah, I think 2020 was a really bad winter. 21 was a really bad winter. I think the blue tongue, the bad winter, and then drought too can be a major factor as well. And that's probably if I'm sharing advice with, you know, hunters who might be going out there, like the honey hole that we found, like the spot that we keep going back to year after year after year, and we always fill our tags, even when it's like this year was the worst numbers, we still filled all of our tags. Like we're hunting by a river.
Yeah.
And that river never dries up. There's always water. There's a lot of dried up creeks out there that don't have water, but the river that we're on, there's always deer around there and we're always able to fill the tags. So, but I think droughts definitely play a major factor in the herd health. And then even if you're going after bucks, antler size too, that definitely can, you know, play a toll on that.
Yeah. When you go out there now, are you going out for bucks or is it still like all of these trips in the last 20 times you've been out there? Has it always been like a freezer filling mission?
Mostly bucks now for me. Okay. So normally there'll be four of us that go. I think like we've been out there with as many as like eight or nine people, which is pretty fun, but it gets to be chaos.
Yeah.
So now my ideal size is like me and three other guys. So normally it's me, my dad, my cousin and his kid has been the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And so normally one of us will have a buck tag. This last year we had two buck tags because my cousin's kid, this is pretty cool. If you have a kid, you can get like an up and coming hunter tag for like half the price. So his kid gets a buck tag for like $300. So normally it'll be like one buck and then three does, or, you know, you can get a surplus doe tag or something. So that's the general plan.
Gotcha. Okay. And so what has the quality been like throughout the years? Does it directly correspond with the dips in the population equal smaller bucks? Or is there another cycle that you've kind of noticed about the ebbs and flows of antler size?
Ooh, that's a good question. The quality has been pretty consistent. I think, normally whitetails like in the 120 to 150 range, like are pretty common out there. The best one I got was 145 out there.
And that's a whitetail or a mule deer? Okay.
That was a whitetail.
Does that tag allow you to shoot whitetails or mule deer?
Yep.
Okay. All right, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So the tag is you can shoot a whitetail or a muley, buck or doe.
Okay.
So you can, if you get the tag, you can shoot anything you want, except for there's a new rule this year where if it's a mule doe, it can only be on private land, not on public.
Okay.
Because they let people shoot eight mule does for years and now they're like, oh, they're all dead. We got to let them come back. And then muleys have been the range, again, probably 120 to 160. The biggest I've shot out there was probably like 120. Mm-hmm. And part of my problem is like, in the last probably 5 years, I've started to like pay attention to age class and like realize like, oh, I can shoot bucks. It's not impossible.
Yeah.
But the problem is I'm only out there for like a 4-day hunt and I want to get back to my family. And I also want to we go at the end of October. So while I'm out there, my trail cams in Wisconsin are blowing up and I'm like, crap, I want to be in Wisconsin. And then I also have a family. So it's like, I want to finish my hunt here, fill my tags, get home, take the kids trick or treating and get to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And what keeps happening is I'm like, I'm going to be patient this year. I'm going to hold out. I'm going to wait till I see a giant. And then the first morning I see a deer that it's like, oh, damn it. I wouldn't pass this one on the last day. And then I squeeze the trigger and it's dead. And I'm like, frick, well, this is awesome. But, and that actually 3 years ago, this was the first morning, again, 8 o'clock in the morning, we just started hunting. I glass up three muleys about a half mile away on this rock. And I'm like, I'm going for them. I can make a play. There's some nice bucks in there. So I drive around and park the truck. I stock up about 300 yards. I army crawl up, peek over this rock, and they're right 75 yards. They're right there. And there's one standing up on the ledge, and there's two just below the other side of the hill. And the one that's standing up was decent, but the two below, I'm like, I think they're better. So I sat there for probably, I don't know, 10 minutes, like with my crosshair on the shoulder of that one, just waiting, like, come on, are they going to come? And then the wind started to swirl and I got nervous. And because the deer started, like the one started like looking over at my direction, and I got nervous and panicked and shot and dropped them. And then the other two came up over the ridge and I was like, oh my gosh, like they were just beautiful. One was still fully in velvet. He was probably like, I don't know, 140, 145. And then the other one, like that same class. So the one I shot was like 115, which was, I was like, all right, that's fine. That's a good deer.
Yeah.
But had I waited another 5 minutes, they either would have smelled me and ran away, or they would have stepped out and I would have shot a bigger one.
Yeah. What have the discrepancies been between public and private? Is there on the public that you've hunted versus the private that you've hunted, or the block management where you have to like sign up to go to those specific places? Is it noticeable?
Not really. And one of the unique things is there's where we hunt, there's a giant piece of public that everyone goes to. So it's a huge, thousands and thousands of acres, and that's where everyone goes to hunt. And so we're, the public that we hunt on are little parcels of, hey, here's 100 acres here, and here's 400 acres here, and here's 40 acres here. And so a lot of those little pieces of public get overlooked. And so we barely run into any traffic on the public that we do hunt, because they're just little parcels that people don't pay attention to. Everyone goes to the big piece of land. And they, I think they do fine and get deer out there, but we're on the private that we're on, you know, we'll have permission there, and then we'll go to little pieces of state land or BLM, or it's BLM that's connected to the private that we're on. And so we don't, it works out pretty good.
Do you have to pay a trespassing fee, or is there still like hope in permission, just knocking and being...
Yeah, we don't pay a dollar to hunt out there. So the land that we hunt on, it's just through permission and relationships.
Yeah.
The house that we stay in now, it is the rancher that owns it. He doesn't let us hunt on his land, but he has this little crappy cabin that we sleep in. So we do pay him a very reasonable rate to stay at that house. So we have a shower and running water and a toilet.
Yep.
But then we hunt on his neighbor's ranch, which she just lets us go out there and hunt. And then there's other property owners around there that we don't have access to every year. But if we're having a hard time, we'll go knock on the door and just explain, hey, we hunted here. You know, we're staying over at so-and-so's ranch. We're trying to fill one more tag. Would you let us come out? And I would say we're about 50-50 in getting permission. I mean, most of the time they're pretty cool. And they'll be like, yeah, I suppose you can go get one. This last year was a little bit tougher because the numbers are down. So we did have a, you know, some ranches that would normally say yes to us. We're like, no, I'd rather you not. Numbers are down.
Yeah.
And very rarely, I had probably two people that were kind of assholes about it. You know, it's like, hey, I try to be nice. I look them in the eyes. I shake their hands. I say please and thank you. And every once in a while you'll get somebody's like, no, I don't want you hunting out here. It's like, all right, well, you know, have a good day. Take care.
Yeah.
But most people are there. They're super nice. And if you go up there and you're respectful and say please and thank you, like, and a lot of times I'll state my case too, like I'll be like, hey, I have my 68-year-old dad in the truck who can't hear and can't see really well, and we need to get him a deer. Maybe I shouldn't say he can't see, that could be dangerous.
He's blind, but he's rifle hunting.
And acknowledging things too, like I might say, like, hey, I know those cattle, if we shoot a cow, I know I'm paying for it, so we're not going to shoot your cows.
Yeah,
would you mind if we go hunt deer? And a lot of times, people are super chill about it.
Cool. One thing that I have ran into in the past, especially in South Dakota, you have the ability to use your tag on a mule deer or a whitetail. And there's whitetails in Iowa. Actually, there's pretty good whitetails in Iowa. Everybody knows that. But for some reason, there was a handful of years where I would find myself gravitating away from mule deer country into whitetail country. And I would start focusing on whitetails. And then I would shake my head and I'd be like, wait a second, I didn't drive 11 hours to come hunt whitetails. I came here to go hunt mule deer. Did you ever, or do you still ever like have that internal debate of why am I here if I'm hunting whitetails because that we don't have mule deer in Minnesota?
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the whole network galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds. For whatever you love, infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
A little bit. There's two parts to that. One is just the trip and the experience itself is so fun that like, I don't care. Like going out there with my family, the memories being, it's such a beautiful place and it's calm. Like, you know, for several years there was no phone service. So we'd be completely off the grid and unplugged.
Awesome.
So part of it was just like, I just want an opportunity to be with my family and hunt deer. And that's fun. But I do, like this year, like I had a buck tag. I'm like, I'm going to shoot a muley. That's my target. I'm going to find a muley. I'm going to be patient. And that's what's going to happen. And then, you know, first day goes by. We saw some small muleys. Saw one really nice white tail, but he was didn't have a shot opportunity at him. Second day goes by. Didn't fill the tag. Third day goes by. I'm like, okay. Or maybe it was the second day. And I glassed up a pretty good white tail. And I was like, oh, gosh, I was going to shoot a muley, but dang it, that deer really looks like he wants to die. And then, whoops, he accidentally died, which was pretty cool because he was still in full velvet in late October. So that was surprising to me. But the kicker was the next morning I was sitting up on hill glassing, you know, helping out family. And there was just a beautiful muley that walked out. And I was like, dang it, I could have shot a muley, but here again, I shot a whitetail. So I go out there intending to shoot a muley. That's the ideal. But where we hunt, there's a pretty, like, they're intermixed. It's not like, hey, there's going to be whitetails here and muleys here. It's like where we're hunting, you have just as good a chance of seeing one as the other.
Yeah.
And so for me, it comes down to, does this deer get my heart racing? If it does, heck yeah, I'm going to shoot it and enjoy it. And then the next morning, I might be bummed when I see a beautiful muley walk out and be like, oh, what could have been? That happened 3 years ago, I think, too. I shot a muley the first day. It was a decent buck. And then a couple days later, I was just out on a drive in the afternoon, and there were two, like, 150 muleys laying on some BLM 50 yards off the road, just laying there. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I did get out and chase them up the hill so they didn't get shot, hoping to preserve them for future years. But I'm like, guys, get out of here.
That's hilarious.
Somebody's gonna kill you.
That's hilarious. When it comes to like taking these trips, let's talk logistics for a second.
Yeah.
What are some things, like, obviously you had a guy kind of show you the ropes as far as, you know, your dad or going with your, you know, those, that group of people right off the bat at an early age. What are some of the logistics that are planned or the planning portion of these trips every year going out? I know you're staying at a house, so you're not backpacking or doing any of that stuff, but talk to me a little bit about the planning and preparation for this trip every year.
Yeah, that goes, I would say it's probably become like my trip that I lead, because over the years I've built the relationships with, like, with the rancher that we stay at now and where we have permission. And so I'm pretty much a point person that sets it up with the family.
Yeah.
So first thing, like, this time of the year, I'm trying to round up like who's going, because Bucktag applications are due in March and doe tag apps aren't until June, but still I want to know like who's going to come with, who's going to apply. So I'm, you know, messaging family, messaging friends. I always love bringing new hunters out there. People have never shot a deer, but want to learn to hunt.
Yeah.
So I've done that probably three or four times where it's like, come with me on this trip for $500. You can shoot your first deer and have an incredible hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot this year. And then once we get into the actual trip, I've got it pretty dialed in because I have a spreadsheet that I've made that I just copy and paste every year with, okay, how many miles we got to drive? How much is gas right now? How much is that going to cost? What food do we need to bring? Normally we have, if there's four guys coming, everybody bring one meal for dinner. For breakfast, we just get eggs and bacon and cook that up in the morning before we leave. And then everyone's on your own for lunch and drinks, like do it yourself.
Yep.
And then we also got a roundup. We butcher all the deer out there too, or we'll quarter them up because we can't bring the heads or the spines back.
Yep.
So then we got to make sure we got, hey, do we have our butchering tables? Do we have our knives? Do we have the sawzall?
Yep.
All of that stuff, which we've done it enough now where basically I have a gear tote that I load up with all my stuff. And then we get everything packed up and every guy that comes with throws $500 into an envelope and we use that to just pay expenses, you know, along the way. And it's a pretty dialed in system overall, I would say. So it's not too, like this year, I think I started packing the night before, like it was a Thursday night and we were leaving Friday morning. I'm like, oh, I should probably pack now. And part of that, I have two young kids, so there's not a lot of free time to do that anymore. And then one thing, when we were younger, especially when I was younger, we used to drive out Friday night, drive through the night and hunt Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
But as I just turned 40 last summer. And a few years ago, I realized like I would get there Saturday and just be so tired all day Saturday. Mm-hmm. And I'm like sitting in the field trying to stay awake and dozing off. And, you know, by Sunday evening, I'd finally be back to like, okay, I feel good.
Yeah.
And now I have to go home in 2 days.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, screw this. If I'm going to take this trip out there, I'm going to take Friday off. We're going to leave Friday morning, have a nice peaceful drive out there, get there, get camp set up, go to bed and then get up Saturday and hunt.
Yeah.
And so that was one thing I would encourage people. I know it's tough, right? Cause days off are limited, but mm-hmm. if you're going to go all the way out there, don't spend half your trip being exhausted and tired and like take the extra time and enjoy it.
Yeah. I feel that. I've started doing that as well. Like I used to, man, we'd get in a car and we would drive. I mean, especially if I went on an elk hunt, it's straight mm-hmm. through the night to Colorado or straight through the night to Idaho. I used to do the wake up at 4 a.m. and drive all the way through to South Dakota. And I would just be freaking exhausted. Not to mention then usually behind in work and trying to do work, bounce, you know, work back and forth from a truck. Hopefully my computer's charged or do I need to go into town and all make sure my phone is charged and all that stuff. Until I just halfway, I would stop at a hotel, spend the night, drive half distance, find a cheap rat hole motel.
Yep.
And then do it again. Cause you know, the cool thing about out west is yes, hunters are coming in, but most of the summer rates have now shifted on hotels. Yep. And so instead of a hotel being $150, man, there's still times where I can find a hotel for $50 and it, or $70 or something like that. And it's fairly affordable to just, and then you back your truck up. I always ask for a ground floor. I bring my overnight bag in. I pull my truck up to the window, sleep with my windows open, and I can see right into my truck and no one's going to mess with it. So I have since stopped trying to be tough and travel through the night.
Yeah, yeah. We did. I went with a buddy. He got an Arizona elk tag this year.
Yep.
And so I went with on that trip because I want to learn elk hunting. And they're like, this is a place to go learn because there's elk everywhere. And so we did a 24-hour drive through the night, got there. But then on the way home after like 10 days without a shower and sleeping in, you know, sleeping in a trailer on the way home. We're like, we're getting a hotel, and man, a warm bed and a hot shower was unbelievable. Yeah, totally worth it.
Fact.
Yeah.
Okay. So based off of what you've told me, I can assume, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, that the tag that you try to get every year is it over the counter, or is it just you apply for it and as of right now you're getting it?
Yep. Yep. I've drawn every time in the area that I hunt. I just do it's a drawing that goes in by the end of March, and I've been drawn every time with no bonus points, no anything. I just pay the fee and wait for the drawing and get the tag. I do know I had an uncle who put in a couple years ago and didn't get drawn, but I've been fortunate. I don't know if I just have good luck or what it is, but
yeah,
I've been drawn every time for that tag.
And is it over the counter, or do you still have to apply for it with a 100% draw success?
I still have to apply for it.
Okay, all right.
So I have to put in for the, so I'm in a drawing, and there are some people who don't get drawn, but I've just been fortunate enough where I've gotten drawn for the tag every time.
Yeah. And that's a doe tag. So are you applying
that's the buck tag. The buck tag is the one with the drawing. So that's a general deer tag where you can get a whitetail or a muley, buck or doe. So that's the one due in March. And then if you want to get just a doe tag, those are due like in June. And that's also a lottery for mule deer doe. And I think whitetail you can just buy over the counter. So mule deer doe is a lottery. And then like in August, they open up if there's any surplus tags. So then you can buy, if there's surplus big game tags, which I don't think there ever is, or buck tags.
Yeah.
But then if you want to buy a surplus mule deer or whitetail doe tag, you can get those later in the year.
Gotcha. Okay. Have you had any interest in going out there in a different time of year with a bow and trying the spot and stock thing with archery equipment?
Yes, I think I'm on my way there. 'Cause again, I've been bow hunting for like 3 years now.
Yep.
So I've killed a few deer. I've got some under my belt. But it's part of it. Like right now while my dad's still hunting, he's 68. Mm-hmm. So right now, like how we do the trip, I'm going to keep doing it that way because I don't know. I mean, hopefully he can keep hunting for another, you know, 10, 15 years, but also at some point he's not going to be able to go. So for right now, it's like, and there's other, like, I want to do more elk hunting. I want to get into some other stuff, but this trip, it's just like a sacred family, like experience that I probably won't mess with. And then like where I bow hunt in Wisconsin, like there's some awesome property there too. So, and even with a young family, like I can shoot over to Wisconsin and hunt a couple days in September, get my fix in, come back, then go out to Montana and rifle hunt out there, and then come back to Wisconsin and bow hunt. And then if I fill my Wisconsin tag, then I'll go, you know, hunt up in Minnesota, land up there. But so I think it's in the cards. I'll probably do it at some point, but right now, just the season of life with, you know, where family's at, where my kids are at, it's a good thing going that I'll keep on doing.
Yeah. Last question. And I believe you've kind of answered it already, but what does this hunt mean to you every single year? And maybe not just the family aspect of it, but the Montana aspect of it.
Yeah. Ooh, that's a good one. Man, it's really like, what is it? It's probably like my favorite trip of the year. Like for me, like hunting is my number one hobby. I went all in on hunting deer and big game. So there's a lot of other stuff I love to do. Like golfing is fun for me, but I don't spend time or money golfing. Now, if someone invites me to go golfing, I might go, but also I'm not going to burn family time because I'm banking that up for my deer hunting trips. Like I cash in all my brownie points October through November.
Right.
I'm gone. And so for me getting to go out there, it's just like the fullness of just getting to do what I love from a very, like, this is a passion for me. I love to do it. When I go to Montana, For several years, I never had any phone service. So I was completely off the grid. Like, yeah. I don't think about work. I don't think about responsibility. The only thing I do is I wake up and I go sit outside and watch a sunrise and I look for deer. And then I get in the truck and I drive around and look for deer. And then I eat a sandwich and I look for deer. And then I watch a sunset and I look for deer. And like, that might be crazy to some people. For me, it's an absolute blast. And so it's a chance to recharge. It's a chance to just be in a new environment. There's no people out there, which is amazing. I mean, I love people. I'm extroverted, but it's also nice. Like, there's no airplanes. There's no cars driving by. Like, you might hear a bird's wings flap over your head every once in a while.
Yeah.
But just the peace, the solitude, the wildlife, getting to see, you know, getting to see for miles. And then even just a slower pace, like sitting down to, you know, talk with the ranchers. Like, we'll go sit and have a coffee with them after a hunt and just getting to connect with them. It's like a simpler time of life. Like, things are so simple out there. A lot of them don't have internet. They live their simple lives. They take care of their cattle. And it's really fun for me because it's just a peaceful time to unplug and just go be present and do what I love.
Yeah. And you wouldn't be going to these properties over and over again if you disrespected the land and or the ranchers, right? So,
correct.
You know, you've built these relationships over the course of, and it's not just you, it's you and your dad have generated these relationships with the locals out there that have allowed you to hunt their property. And that's something that I feel is very rare these days. I feel, and it's just my gut talking, and maybe I'm not, you know, maybe it's my gut talking, but I feel like a lot of people go, take, and then that's it. They go, they fill their tag, they leave, and there's no bonding, or maybe they get permission and then it's over, right? It's just like, boom, go. Maybe they need help for a day. Maybe, you know, it's their land. I think there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And hence why I've run into some, I don't know, I'll call them assholes as far as landowners have been out there, but it's probably because guys like me come there, they take, and they don't say thank you. They don't, you know, they don't treat their land or their cattle or themselves with respect. And then they get a bad taste in their mouth. And now everybody who comes is an asshole. And I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. One thing that I try and intentionally do with any of the ranches we go to is I'll send like a handwritten thank you card. Like when we get home that year, I'll send a thank you card. For the ranches that we go back to year after year, I always send them like our family Christmas card. Like if I can say, hey, look at my beautiful family, my, you know, amazing wife and my beautiful kids, that always opens a lot of doors. And then I always ask before we come out there, like the two primary places we go, I'm like, do you need me to bring anything? We're going to be driving through town. What can I pick up for you? Do you need me to get you a new microwave off Marketplace? Like, and they hardly ever say. One year they did need a microwave actually, so I brought that. But then when we get there, I'm like, hey, we're around. What do you need help with? You know, how? And most of the time, again, they're like, oh no, we're good. But I always like, we're here for a couple of days. How can we help you out? This year we did help erect, one of the ranchers was building a greenhouse. So we help them stand up some trusses because they were trying to do it with two guys. We're like, no, here we got, let us jump out of the truck. We'll be done in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I always volunteer our time. Most of the time they don't want it.
Yeah.
Even ranchers where I stop for the first time and say, hey, can we hunt your land? I'm also like, also, do you need any help around the place? Cause we're happy to serve in that manner.
Yeah.
And I think that goes a long way too, just recognizing that like ranching is damn tough work.
Yeah.
Especially when it's, when the weather gets crappy or there's different conditions going on. So, I think that goes a long way too, just like, hey, I see you, I see your job is tough and yes, we want to hunt your land, but also how can I, you're benefiting me. How can I serve you? How can I say thank you besides, which I do say thank you, but even just the offer to help, I think goes a long way.
Yeah. One question you said the buzzword there that kicked on into my head, and that was weather. I want to end on this, and that is, what has the weather, so this hunt takes place in late October, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's normally the opening of rifle season out there.
Yep.
Like the first, I always try and get there for the opening of rifle. And that's strategic because then the deer are still pretty chill. They haven't been chased. They haven't had people shooting at them from the road. It's a little easier to go after them, I think.
So what has the weather been? Is there a specific date? Is it like October 20th every year?
Yeah, it's like the third Saturday of October.
Okay.
So it'll either be like from the 19th to like the 24th or 25th, depending on the year.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about all the different types of weather experiences you've had while being out there.
Yeah. I would say the full range. The best buck I shot out there, that big whitetail, it was 0 degrees and it snowed about 8 inches that night and it was still snowing and there was about a 20-mile-an-hour wind. And that one I shot it, I think it was about 8 in the morning I shot him. So it was just absolutely brutal. Terrible of conditions. Like, this is like, I'm going to sit in the truck as long as possible today because I do not want to be outside.
Yeah.
So we've had that. And then I've had years out there where, I think this year is pretty decent, but I've had years out there where it's been 70 degrees and I'm literally taking my boots off and sitting in a t-shirt and getting a suntan out there.
Yeah.
So most of the time we're bouncing between, like, it will freeze at, I'd say between 30 and 50 is pretty standard weather for us out there.
Yeah.
But we have had, you know, 0 up to 70.
Yeah. That blows my mind how fast out west weather can change in a heartbeat. Yeah. I can remember sitting in a t-shirt and having my pants vents open, glassing mule deer. And I look behind me. And there's a darkness rolling across the landscape. And this gigantic gust of wind just goes, whoom, temperature drops from like 70 to 20 in just like a matter of minutes. I mean, that's a 50 degree swing in a matter of minutes and it starts snowing. And I'm like, holy shit. I have to get back to my truck or I'm going to get hypothermia. Right. And so I had to bail and head back and cause it was snowing and starting to melt and get slippery and slushy out there and things like that. So, well,
yeah, that's serious. That can happen out there. The roads too, the two tracks.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets wet, like there's days, like if it's dry out there, you can go anywhere. You could drive through anything, but you get an inch of rain and the roads turn, we call it gumbo. It just turns into complete slime.
Yeah.
And we've had some pretty crazy encounters where even this last year, actually, we drove through about, it was about an hour straight of total clench, like hanging on for dear life. And I'm like, why am I doing this? This is stupid. We're going to get stuck 3 miles into this pasture and I'm going to have to walk back. Fortunately, we made it through. We ended up getting a deer. So that was cool. Yeah. But that's something to, I guess, for new people, if they're going out there, to really pay attention to the moisture level.
Yeah.
Because you can drive in on a road and it's just fine. And 3 hours later, good luck, you're not getting out of there.
Yeah. I feel that, man. I've had a couple pucker moments where it just gets like, you're like, oh, shit, am I going to fall? Like, because if I go in the ditch, it's over, you know?
That's it. This is where we're staying.
Well, Bob, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk about this experience with us. Thank you very much for your time. And for all of those who are listening, do me a huge favor and take an opportunity to go check out our partners over at Wasp Archery and Montana Decoys. Two really good brands that help support this podcast. Also, the Western Rookie Podcast now has a YouTube channel, which we will be posting all of the videos on. So go subscribe to the Western Rookie Podcast channel and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you download this. Thank you very much, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bob, appreciate your time.
Yep. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it. Take care.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
It's tax season, and at LifeLock, we know you're tired of numbers. But here's a big one you need to hear. Billions. That's the amount of money and refunds the IRS has flagged for possible identity fraud. Now here's another big number. 100 million. That's how many data points LifeLock monitors every second. If your identity is stolen, we'll fix it guaranteed. One last big number. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/podcast for the threats you can't control. Terms apply.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.